The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
It's Cartoonerific. 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 It's Cartoonerific. With your host, Brian Mitchell.
Well, howdy, partners, and welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I'm your host, Brian Mitchell. Thank you for coming back. We have a delightful show today, and I don't use delightful too often, but it seemed fitting here. When I was growing up in the 60s, when I was a toddler, watching all these cartoons and being mesmerized, in the late 60s, all of a sudden there was a new show that came on, and NBC premiered it. It was a cartoon show about a panther, and it had this weird guy that was an inspector, so featured some cartoons about a little ant and an aardvark that was trying to eat him. They were nothing like I'd ever seen before. I mean, I'd seen bold cartoons before, but this was interesting because the designs were really bold and the colors were bright and it had fresh music. It wasn't the typical cartoony music that you would hear on a Tom and Jerry cartoon or a Disney or a Walter Lance or a Looney Tunes cartoon. It didn't have the big band sound, but it had a jazzy sound. And there were interesting themes. Very different from the typical cartoon. Being so different and fresh and new and even funny, these cartoons totally mesmerized me as the show went from its half-hour season to the next season where it was expanded to an hour, and then the following year to an hour and a half. So I ended up watching those cartoons and absolutely loving them. And I knew they weren't full animation. Kid at 9 or 10 years old, I didn't really pick up on why they kind of looked the way they looked or whatever, but they were thoroughly enjoyable. Those were the cartoons produced by a studio called DePatie Freleng. And the cartoons we're talking about are the Pink Panthers and the Ant and the Aardvark and the Inspector and the Tijuana Toads, a.k.a. the Texas Toads, and many, many more. They were very interesting cartoons. They've been put out over the years by MGM. MGM basically owns those cartoons along with a couple other people. But Kino Lorber acquired all those cartoons for release, and basically they put them out on disc. They put them out on DVD and Blu-ray, lovingly restoring these cartoons and putting them out, which is terrific. Our guest actually did some commentary on these DVDs and Blu-rays. He's the author of Think Pink, the story of the DePatie Freleng Studio. That is Mr. Mark Arnold, and he is our guest for today. He's coming up next. Don't go away.
Cartoonerific is the place to be to celebrate hand-drawn animated cartoons. The Cartoonerific podcast features interviews with the magic makers behind your favorite animated cartoons, with episodes uploaded every Friday. Or visit the Cartoonerific blog featuring articles about classic cartoon animation. At the Cartoonerific Gallery, view original animation art and memorabilia from your favorite animated films and TV shows. The company store features exclusive swag from the Cartoonerific universe. And coming soon, brand new world premiere cartoons on the Cartoonerific channel. It's all here. Join the fun at www.cartoonerific.com. That's cartoon, E-R-I-F-I-C.com. It's Cartoonerific. Saving the universe one funny cartoon at a time. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
Well, welcome back. We have on a special guest today. He's an author. He's written a bunch of books on pop culture, but mostly on animated cartoons. Books that I never would ever think that anybody would write about. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's just that some of these subjects are not in the mainstream.
Mr. Arnold has written books on Harvey Comics, Total Television Cartoons, which includes Underdog, and of course, I go blank right now, Tennessee Tuxedo, and a bunch of others. He wrote a book on Alvin, the story of Ross Bagdasarian Sr., and a book that I just saw, Frozen in Ice, the story of Walt Disney Productions from 1966 to 1985. Please welcome author Mark Arnold. Hey, Mark, Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I know that introduction didn't sound so marvelous, but I'll sweeten it up in post, and I'll add some applause and all that other wonderful stuff. So, part of the reason why I wanted to have you on, we're talking about Think Pink, which is your book about the story of DePatie Freleng Enterprises, and some people don't like those cartoons because they seem like they are kind of a ripoff of the Warner Brothers cartoons, because basically it's all the same people, and they do reuse a lot of stories, but they did a lot of fresh material as well. And I happen to really like those cartoons. I think they're the first cartoon that came out from them won an Academy Award, and that was a Pink Panther cartoon. So yes. They definitely, Friz Freleng and Holly Pratt and John Dunn and the people that were there, Art Leonardi, they made a terrific team. Can you tell us how DePatie Freleng started? It started from the remnants of the old Warner Brothers cartoon studio, correct?
Right. Yeah. Basically, the whole Warner Brothers Animation Studio had a number of different leaders, and I'm not totally versed on who was who over the years. I mean, it's Termite Terrace, as you may have heard over the years on the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank. And the last head of the studio for that division was David DePatie. And unfortunately, he got the mandate saying, well, we've done enough cartoons, let's wrap it up, basically. And so Chuck Jones had already left because it was kind of winding down anyway. And it was just slowly running down, like I said. And so he consulted with the one animation director he really liked and was a buddy with, which was Friz Freleng, and just invited him and said, hey, this is closing down. What do you say you and I pool our resources and we'll start our own studio? And Friz hemmed and hawed for a bit. And even Friz left for a bit before this happened and worked briefly for Hanna-Barbera on the feature, Hey There, It's Yogi Bear. So it wasn't like a real cut and dried story. In fact, if you read in the book, a lot of this stuff overlaps. It wasn't like, one day we're Warner Brothers, and now we're DePatie Freleng. It's like things were kind of sloshing over.
trying to figure out where they're going. I think the same thing happened over at Hanna-Barbera when they were leaving MGM. And I think there was a whole deal with Bill Hanna and Michael Law and maybe somebody else involved to do commercials and stuff. Or I think it was Crusader Rabbit, actually. I think that had something to do with it. But then they were linked up with George Sidney, and then George Sidney said, well, you need this other guy. You need Joe. Keep the team together and then create a new production company. But however it happens, So when they finally they shook hands on this thing, the big mystery, we've been talking about this, actually. I said in a previous the podcast that's on this this past week that the story that I heard was that they got the studio for free because DePatie was basically he had a relative in upper management, so so they basically just said, look, we'll help you get started, just use the studio facility. Then I heard another story that to make it legal, it was like $1 a year. You have the actual scoop on this, correct?
Yeah.
So what actually happened?
It's a little bit of both. It was like some handshake deal. And to make it legal, they had to do it like $1 a year. But essentially, it was the same studio, but now they were using it for free on, on the Warner Brothers lot for outside productions. So,
So basically, it was all this equipment. They had the cameras, which animation cameras back in that day were like, first of all, they were rare. And if you wanted one that shot 35 millimeter film, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars for an animation camera. Yeah. And so, you know, the fact that they got the studio's turnkey operation, basically they didn't even have to move their butts out of their chairs, really. They could have just, you know. And
I mean, it's really kind of strange because DePatie and Freleng just really lucked out. And Warner Brothers really made what I consider kind of a critical error.
Just like at MGM, you know, 10 years before that, or not 10 years, 5 years before that, 6 years. Because they did the same thing. And then all of a sudden they realized, oh, wait, these things actually make us money.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what happened.
The prevailing thinking was, of course, the TV was taking over and theatrical cartoons were done. And they solidified that by making the Bugs Bunny show originally as a primetime series. And they figured, you know, we don't need to do any more cartoons. We'll just show that. And the last projects they were working on were just a few, you know, typical, you know, Looney Tunes and a couple specials and things like that. And the very last thing was the animation for the Incredible Mr. Limpet that Don Knotts.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they didn't even use their own people. I think they brought in Bill Tytla from New York.
Right.
Bill Tytla had been living in New York. So he went out to work on this thing, and all the time he was trying to get back at Disney. But, but then you had, I think, other Disney animators working on it too. Right. I mean, did Abe Levito work on that? I don't even think so.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think you're correct on that, but I'm not positive on it. But yeah, that's what they ended with on the original Warner Brothers studio. And then what DePatie Freleng started with, basically, Warner Brothers had some ad contracts already in place, and they continued on with those and did more animated commercials for things like Gillette Razor and Starkus Tuna with Charlie the Tuna and things like that. And then as time went on, they graduated from just doing those, you know, commercial spots to doing titles for movies. Mm-hmm. And they were doing okay, but they weren't doing being terribly successful at it, but you know, they just keep plugging away and just doing projects and it kept them busy and stuff like that.
Right.
And then I don't know if you're going to ask the question, but then when did their fortunes turn? Well, of course, you know, they started doing titles for movies and things like that. But the one title that everybody knows now that was the one that changed all their fortunes was doing the titles for Blake Edwards' Pink Panther film. He just had a live action picture and he said, this might be good to have some animated titles, you know, and he wasn't even thinking about making an actual Pink Panther character. He just said, just make some titles for my film.
Right.
Yeah.
But they still had history. They still had to create the character. And I think Holly Pratt, which I was talking with Willie Ito about this earlier, was saying it doesn't seem to get that much, I guess, people don't really mention that name too well. You know, you always hear the same people over and over and over again. Chuck Jones, you'll hear Friz Freleng, Mel Blanc, and then, you know, Disney, you know, now it's, Andreas Deja and Glenn Keane and people like that. You hear about all those people, but you never hear about Holly Pratt, who was a brilliant artist, and he was a good director. He was a really good director.
Right. From what I know, and from, you know, interviewing other people for the book, I scoured and looked everywhere and consulted everyone to see if there was like an interview somewhere in print or audio or something with Holly Pratt. And the only thing I got out of people is like, oh yeah, I talked to Holly Pratt, but I never really thought about recording it, you know. And all they just basically said, he was a very nice man and he was very soft spoken. And I think that's a lot to do with it, is he didn't go out of his way to say, hey, I created Pink Panther, it was my deal, you know. It was just something he did. And you know, he directed some of the shorts, he directed other things and, you know, just went on with his life. He wasn't a big grandstander about his own achievements.
So. Yeah, I guess some of those guys just considered it a job, and it wasn't like they were going to go out there and, you know, kind of tout their successes, you know. Yeah. When Warner Brothers shut down, they had the pick of the litter of the people in that studio to take on. So Hawley was one of them. I think Art Leonardi was, I don't know if he left the studio and then came back. I mean,
he did very briefly. In fact, everybody left. There was, you know, just a little slim window. And basically, I don't know if I can swear on here or not, but, you know, I could clean it up for, you know, or you can bleep it, whatever. You know, apparently he got a telegram.
I'll put some cartoon sound effects over it. Yeah.
Apparently, Art Leonardi got a telegram that said, get your ass back here. Because he was starting to work on other projects, doing storyboarding and other commercial projects that had nothing to do with Warner Brothers, nothing to do with DePatie Freleng. And he was just moving on to his other part of his career. And I think he actually had moved from California to New York, where you are.
Right.
And was going to do the next chapter of his life. He wasn't looking backwards. And that's when DePatie, I'm sure it was for his Freeling, said, we need him, you know, and a few others. Mm-hmm. And he basically rehired his entire unit and the entirety of Bob McKimson's old unit and pretty much everyone from Chuck Jones's unit that was available. A lot of people stayed with Chuck Jones, but, you know, anybody who was available that, you know, would be willing to work that worked with old Warner Brothers. Yeah. They tried to bring back in. They got a lot of them.
Right. So. Wow. It's incredible. Yeah. You know, like I said, it's a turnkey studio really, because these people are out and, you know, all I had to do is just call them up, ring them up on the phone. And that was it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and so anyway, so we know when the fortune started to turn with that, but what happened? Okay. They did the titles. The titles went over pretty darn well. Right. Mm-hmm. So the film came out and there were certain reviewers that actually liked the titles over the feature film. And I heard, I'm not sure if this is true. I heard that basically people wanted to see the titles again in the theaters. Is that true? Or
I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that maybe from,
different variety of reviewers, variety of the publication reviewer, reviews and stuff like that, that I've seen different things. I did a lot of research on different, old publications like that. And yeah, there was, differing reports that, people really enjoyed those titles. They thought they're really funny and clever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there wasn't really a talk initially to make it a series or anything. But then once the word and the buzz about it came about, why not? You know?
I'm sure the people that produced it, was it the Marish brothers or whatever?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was brothers or whatever, but the Marish group. And then you had Blake Edwards and all that. I'm sure that they heard over and over again, you know, wow, those titles for that movie was excellent. I'm sure when they heard it often enough that it just became a no-brainer for them.
Yeah. And, well, the wheels started spinning for all of them, especially DePatie and Freeling, because they both realized that they could actually own one of these characters instead of doing a Bugs Bunny that was owned by Warner Brothers or any other character. You know, that's like, wow, this is a character. They didn't own 100% of it because, of course, Blake Edwards owned part of it. The Marish Brothers owned part of it. But still, they owned some of it, which, you know, with any of the Looney Tunes, they didn't own any of it. So some is better than none. So
yeah,
there you go.
And they were collecting a paycheck on top of that. So
exactly.
So do you know what exactly happened? Did they approached Friz and DePatie and what?
I think it was more DePatie and that? Freeling thought it up, saying we need to do more with this. Like Blake Edwards, he's a filmmaker. He wasn't really thinking about making his titles into starring characters of shorts.
Right.
Now, he's going to, of course, reap the benefits of it because, you know, that was his film. But, you know, he was going on to direct things like The Great Race and, you know, other things that had nothing to do with Pink Panther. So,
yeah.
And he did one more Pink Panther film, which was a shot in the dark, which actually didn't have the Pink Panther in it.
Right.
And but
that was the with Inspector. The Clouseau character, right?
Yeah, it did have the Inspector in it, at least an earlier version of it. But we'll talk about that later, I guess. But, you know, it wasn't another decade before he did another Pink Panther film that actually had the character.
Yeah, I think it was 74, maybe 74 that he did it.
Yeah. So, I mean, but, you know, like I said, he was reaping the rewards of having being a part owner, but he didn't really care, at least from what I researched, whether it made it into a series of cartoons or not. It was mainly DePatie and Freeland because they wanted to keep their studio afloat. They want, you know, and they go, hey, we could do this with a starring character,
right?
And
so so where did the deal come from? Because I know they got some sweetheart deal to produce all these shorts. It was like a 10-year deal maybe to produce theatricals.
Yeah,
was that the deal?
Interestingly enough, and this is the weird part about the story, and I don't really have it crystal clear as to why Warner Brothers, but they had no interest in this, even though they're, and of course, even though DePatie and Freeling were on the Warner Brothers lot, they were free agents, so they could do whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. So I think basically what they did is they put the word out to all these different studios, and of all the ones that decided to grab it was United Artists, who never really had a theatrical series. I think that they distributed Disney films way back when it was Charlie Chaplin
and Mary Pickford. And,
exactly. Yeah. So they were probably chomping at the bit to say, hey, let's do this. And I can't remember. I have to read my own book. I can't remember if it was before or after the first Pink Panther cartoon, but the first one is the Pink Fink.
Right.
It won an Oscar, mm-hmm. which is amazing. Just right out the gate, the very first cartoon you make is an Oscar winner. So I don't know if it was before or after, but I'm kind of thinking it was directly after. They probably were commissioned to do one. Oh, I know why it was United Artists, because the Pink Panther film, of course, the Pink Panther film was United Artists, so they gave them the first option to do a series from it. But also that mandate, and I've heard differing amounts, and you'll see it in the book. It was like either 100 cartoons, 110 cartoons, 125 cartoons, 150 cartoons. Who knows the exact amount, but it's somewhere between 150 cartoons needed to be made over the next 7 years from DePatie Freeling, mm-hmm. starring Pink Panther or possibly other characters should they emerge. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. So they came up with the Inspector was the next one because that was the logical one. Mm-hmm. And then they came up with these two other characters, the Ant and the Aardvark, which came out of absolutely nowhere, probably out of the demented mind of John Dunne.
And
stuck him with the voices of I think it was Dean Martin, right? And
Jackie Mason.
Sorry, it kind of sounds like it could be Dean Martin.
Dean Martin was the aunt.
The aunt, and then Jackie Mason, right?
You know, that's an imitation. I think there's a couple cartoons that actually had Jackie Mason, but it was really John Byner who did the bulk of it.
Right.
And so he was doing a Jackie Mason imitation and a Dean Martin imitation.
Wow.
And it was Jackie Mason's like, hey, you can't use my voice. And so they said, all right, come and do your own voice. And basically said, this is a lot more work than I thought. So he said, Byner can do my voice. You could just pay me a little royalty. And so that's what they did.
That's what they did. Wow. Wow. I didn't know that. Did Dean Martin get a royalty out of that too? Or
no, he never.
He probably never realized.
He probably didn't care, you know. And, you know, but Dean Martin is like, you know, whereas Mason was popular, but, you know, I'm sure he never made the income Dean Martin did. So
So, but
then a couple other theatricals that we're mentioning ones that came around roughly around the same time, but aren't as well known as they did Roland and Rat Fink.
Yes.
Which is kind of like a good guy versus bad guy type, like an old melodrama type thing, you know.
Right.
And those were a definite John Dunne type creation too. And, you know, they're very creative. There's some that are done completely, like the characters are done just whitewashed. It's just white. There's no color in their anything except on the backgrounds or something. It's just,
I believe, and just knowing animation, knowing Ink and Paint a little bit, mm-hmm. that, they probably did that to save time.
I'm sure they did. It gives it a very different style to do something.
Well,
like
it's
that.
A very graphic look, and you know, you paint the ant all red except for maybe the eyes, you know, and then and then the aardvark is blue.
Yeah,
and Pink Panther is pink, and.
Well, I think they did that. Yeah, it's like once Pink Panther hit, they learned from this, saying, let's make very simple shapes or simple colors, simple ideas. You know, one of their other ones I was going to mention is Tijuana Toads.
Oh,
just two green toads, later known as Texas Toads on television, but it was essentially the same show.
To be politically correct, they dubbed them, didn't they? They dubbed those characters?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is it was the same actors redubbing their own voices. They just didn't put the accent on it.
They're actually very funny cartoons. I found the Texas Toads with, what is it, Crazy Legs Crane? They spun him off, which...
Yeah, that was a later one.
Which they probably shouldn't have spun him off, but he's yellow.
Yeah, he was actually funnier when he was just a supporting character instead of a starring character.
Exactly. You know? No, he's not a starring character. They should have realized that, but I think they felt that, we got to do something.
Yeah.
So, but there's a show called Here Comes the Grump that they did for TV, which was basically it's Yosemite Sam in a grump outfit. Troll, he's kind of like a troll-like character, and then you have the princess. And
Basically, it's a combination of Yosemite Sam cartoon and The Wizard of Oz or something to that effect. You know?
Yeah,
it's like
exactly.
With princesses and other things kind of thrown into the mix. But, I mean, it seems like each time they go to some crazy land, like there's an episode where they go to like a balloon land where all the characters are balloons, you know, things like that. So, but that one was made for television. But strangely enough, I mean, just as an aside, in foreign markets, that cartoon was wildly successful. And in the last 3 or 4 years, an independent studio made a CGI version of Here Comes the Grump. It's not called Here Comes the Grump. I think it's called A Wizard's Tale or something. I mean, you can find it on DVD.
Right.
But, you know, just it's still a DePatty Freleng in name only production because they created the characters, but still it's kind of bizarre that would have any sort of staying power.
That's true. Yeah, DePatty Freleng seemed to be, I mean, aside from the Warner Brothers people I came across, like Bob McKimson and I'm trying to think of some of the story people, because I don't think they used John Dunn was a Warner Brothers story guy that actually took over for, I think, when Maltese left and he was on Chuck Jones. I think he was fashioning stories for all the units over there at Warner Brothers. Isn't that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah. Because Walter Foster left and he went to Hanna-Barbera to make serious dough over there.
And so Mike Maltese.
So they left, and then John Dunn was basically the story guy for all those cartoons. And then basically when they closed down, John Dunn was – he was worth a lot, and he knew he was worth a lot. But and from what I understand, he was always looking for that raise. He was always looking for that grand promotion, which never came. But, I mean, he was kind of the story guy for DePatty Freleng for 20 years.
But there's a few other people that came into their own, like Gary Shinicky. He did a few, directed quite a few cartoons.
Yes.
And, Cornelius or Corny Cole, he did some designs, especially for some of their TV specials, and like the Flip Wilson specials, the comedian.
I saw them when they originally came out.
Yeah.
So I don't remember them.
Very
but...
sketchy look, you know, design look and stuff like that. And you know, there's like Warren Batchelor is a person that came from the old Warner Brothers days that, you know, helped a lot.
Laverne Harding came from, I guess she joined later on. She was from Walter Lantz. I guess when they shut down, she jumped ship. Well, not jumped ship. She just moved over. But
Well, I mean, during the course of the 60s, I mean, Paramount kept making cartoons until like 1967. I think Terry Toons lasted around the same time, and then or like 69.
Yeah, and they were both here in New York.
Yeah. Walter Lantz lasted till 72, and Hanna-Barbera dipped into doing theatricals with a series called Loopy de Loop, but then they just gave it up after that. So really, to Patty Freeling was it after that, and they actually kept theatricals up until 1981, which is amazing to me. But
it is, but you could see like at the end they're kind of sputtering out. But they made some very funny cartoons back in the 60s mm-hmm. and early 70s. And so they still, you know, they had some spark there. The Bob McKimson ended up becoming one of their directors. Who are the other directors over there? Do you know?
I mean, well, like I said, Gary Shinicky did a lot of them. Even right. Art Leonardi directed a few. Holly Pratt directed a few. Mm-hmm. Friz Freleng did some of his final directing efforts. He tended to direct like the first cartoon of any particular series.
To set it in stone.
Yeah. And then once that's done, he just handed it off to everyone else. There is, I'm forgetting the name, but, you know, a later series called Blue Racer that actually, at that point, some of the productions, because doing 150 cartoons is a lot in mm-hmm. a short period of time. So they actually had to farm out some of the productions. And so they farmed out the production to Spain on the Blue Racer, and some of those were directed out of there, and they basically animated it and did everything overseas and then sent it back.
Right.
You know,
did it still look like a DePatie Freleng product?
Yeah, in general, they kept the style pretty good, but there are some strange cartoons that came out.
Yeah.
Some that don't make any sense whatsoever, but you know, it's really weird. I mean, fortunately now you can see them all, because in the last few years, and I had the privilege of doing the commentaries on these, Kino Lorber got the rights to release all the theatrical DePatie Freleng cartoons. And so
right.
slowly over time, I was working with Greg Ford on this.
Right.
And we'd say, well, he'd call me up and he'd say, well, we got to do Roland and Ratfink now. Okay, well, I'll watch all the cartoons and, you know, which ones do you want to do commentaries on? Well, I like this and this one. Well, Jerry Beck's doing commentary on that. Well, I tried to not do the same ones, and so we have different commentaries on them.
Right.
And it was fun to do. The hardest one to do was the last one, which actually wasn't done last, but it was the last one DePatie Freleng did, the Crazy Legs Crane. I mean, it got to the point where if you listen to the DVD commentaries, even Jerry Beck says, I have nothing more to say about this cartoon. Because it was painful. They were wrapping up, you know, productions and everything by that point. I mean, we could talk about that later, but you know, it's right. like, and then the ones we haven't mentioned yet, theatrical, besides Blue Racers, Hoot Klute, which is like this mm-hmm. Cowboy character with his little horse sidekick. And then The Dog Father, which of course was a quickie cash in on The Godfather. So, you know, but with that, dogs.
Was that a series or that was just
that was a theatrical series. Yeah.
Oh, God.
And wow. You mentioned earlier, you said, you know, they started ripping off things. Dog Father is one where I think they did a lot of these. They did 17 cartoons. That was like the magic number that they had to do.
Yeah.
On Dog Father, I think half of them or a little over half of them are total reused Warner Brothers scripts.
Oh, now, sure.
I haven't mentioned in the book which ones are which and stuff like that, but it's the ones where, you know, they have like the big bulldog and the little yippy dog that's like, oh, you're big and strong and la la la, and then they just redid it with different dogs and
right
there's your Dog Father cartoon.
There you go. Just use that, you know. I could just see Frizz saying, just use that cartoon.
Yeah,
just rip it and change it a little. You know,
it's interesting to watch him. I mean, had they not done the original cartoon, like had they just done the Dog Father cartoons and they weren't remakes, mm-hmm. they're not that bad at cartoons. But the unfortunate thing is you get all the Looney Tunes that you can compare it to. And it's like, this was done way better back in the 50s.
Sure. You know? Well, so. they had more money. What was the average budget? Do you know of
I think it varied over the years. But you know, it seems like 100,000 kind of, you know, per cartoons kind of sticks in my head, but I could be totally off on that. Yeah. I have balance sheets and things like that in the book, so again, I don't right. have it all memorized.
I think maybe later on they were probably there, because I think like a Flintstones, the cartoon, the series cost probably between 40,000 and 65,000, 66,000. At the time.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the budgets for these cartoons were probably, you know, if you're using that as a guide, at least I think maybe a third that for each cartoon.
But I will say this. I don't know exact dollar amounts. I'll say that. But right. I do know that there was like different tiers. So most of the TV animation that was just episodic TV, that was probably like the lowest budgets that they had.
Yeah.
Then the next level up were the theatricals that they leased out, because they did lease out some theatricals of Roadrunner to back to Warner Brothers.
Right.
Strangely enough, okay. Later on.
So and when
those did, very low budget for theatrical.
When you know. When did Warners realize? You know, okay, they closed down the animation department. DePatie Freleng are in the studio. They're renting it or whatever. And then all of a sudden, it's like some executive at Warner Brothers goes, you know, we need more of these cartoons. They're actually doing pretty well.
It was pretty quick. It was probably about a year. But I think what's, you know, solidified it was Pink Fink winning the Oscar. They said, hey, there's money to be made in these theatrical cartoons. But
so they struck a deal with them to do more Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
And I think they did some Roadrunners, right? Yeah. And Rudy,
they did all Roadrunners, but they
Rudy LaRiva, I think was one.
Yeah, he was the person I was going to say.
Yeah,
they did. I forgive me if I don't remember the exact number. It's like 14 or something between 1964 and 1967. So they were considered DePatie Freleng cartoons. Fritz Freleng didn't want to have anything to do with them for two reasons. One is, they weren't his characters anymore, or they weren't his characters to begin with. Right. And also, yeah, he never worked on the Roadrunners back in the day. I mean, it's like these weren't his cartoons. He didn't care.
Right.
So that's why he sublet them out to Format Films, who did the Alvin Show, the Ross Bagdasarian's thing.
Yeah.
And also later they did a Lone Ranger series. So, you know, that was their big theatrical claim to fame is for Format Films is doing those Roadrunners that most people don't like.
So. Yeah. I mean, there's one that's really horrible called Run Run Sweet Roadrunner.
Yeah.
And I know about this cartoon because when I was a kid, I had a 16 millimeter projector and I would buy whatever cartoons and I couldn't get any Looney Tunes. And then somebody had, I got this Roadrunner cartoon you might be interested in. And I was like, oh, cool. And I didn't know. I don't think there was a book on the titles and who produced what. I don't think there was. Right. You know, I was like, it was, you know, back in the 70s. So I bought this cartoon for like $30 and I run it and I'm like, it's not a Chuck Jones cartoon. You know, I knew enough that Chuck Jones did the Roadrunner. And then it was just basically this dreck. It had three gags in the cartoon.
Yeah.
And where a Roadrunner cartoon would have 10 gags, but I mean, it was three bad gags and then, you know, but, so is that all they did? I mean, I know they did, I'm not sure if they did it or if it was when Warner Brothers reformed
the cartoon studio. They did a few of the Daffy Duck, Speedy Gonzales ones
too. Yeah, that was a terrific combination.
Yeah. And how that came about was basically, somebody at Warner Brothers, typical executive that's not interested in creativity or animation, looked at the balance sheets and tried to figure out who are the most popular characters worldwide. And apparently Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales fit the bill.
There you go.
Let's do cartoons with them. I don't know why Bugs Bunny wouldn't have made the list, but I think there is always, after the original Warner Brothers studio, until it reopened again, there is always an issue with Bugs Bunny that I'm not totally clear on because I wasn't researching that part for my book.
Right.
Somebody else like a Jerry Beck could probably, you know, figure that out. He was probably, it's typical of something. It's just like the Marvel superheroes. You got these superheroes at this studio. You got this one over here. So Bugs Bunny was too busy shilling Tang or something like that, that he couldn't be starring in theatrical cartoons or something like that. You know,
that's possible, but they may have viewed it as they may have viewed Bugs as the gem and they didn't want to like tamper with that. And they figured they could screw around with the other characters.
Yeah. Daffy Duck. Well, he's had two personalities, so we can mess with him.
that's an interesting concept. Daffy with multiple, he does have multiple personalities through different directors. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So to wrap up the Warner Brothers part of the story, just, you know, for the sake of argument, is like, so in 67, Warner Brothers said, this is really a really odd situation where we're giving Patty Freleng the work, and then they're subleasing it out to Format Films. So at that point, they brought everything back in. Mm-hmm. But also in doing that, they ended the Speedy Gonzales Daffy Duck cartoons, and they also ended the Roadrunner ones, and they did like Merlin the Magic Mouse and Cool Cat and all those weird ones at the end. But
yeah,
hey, they were considered Warner Brothers cartoons again, and yeah, they got McKimson back as a director and stuff like that. But in the meantime, Patty Freleng was still doing their theatricals, and then they NBC approached them, and they wanted to do Pink Panther on television, and DePatie and Freleng pushed them off as far as they could,
right,
which was 5 years. And so they said, well, can you come up with something else that we can put on TV? And that's their first series was The Super Six.
Yes.
Which is
that, and
actually,
that's totally John Dunn. That is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not bad for a TV series. Right. You know, it's like, and then they did like a Dr. Doolittle series, and you know, they slowly rolled them out, but then by the 70s they were never the level of Hanna-Barbera where they had like 8 series on.
No, they were never as big.
They always had like 1 or 2 series each season, right, all the way up until they closed in 1980. So
well they were still they were doing commercials, they were busy doing commercials, they were doing an occasional special.
Yeah, and that was what I didn't finish that thought too. Yeah. It's like, so the different tiers, you had those theatricals, and then the next tier up was, you know, those specials, and they got big dollars for doing like all those Dr. Seuss specials and things like that. So,
right.
And of course, they continued on doing, you know, titles for different TV shows like I Dream a Genie and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, Patty Freleng was really busy, especially in the 60s, well, in the 70s quite a bit too, you know.
Sure.
But they shifted more towards TV because that's where the money went. So, you know.
I think what's interesting is, you know, Chuck Jones did the Grinch special, mm-hmm, which was excellent, brilliant special. And he did another Seuss special, which I think it was Horton Hears a Who.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he got no more Dr. Seuss stuff. And I think there was some sort of a rift between Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, and Chuck Jones. Because I know he was always miffed over the fact that he said the Grinch, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, is Chuck Jones' version of Dr. Seuss.
Right.
And I think
eyelashes,
yeah,
big arching eyebrows and everything.
And I wonder if that's why those specials ended up going to DePatie Freleng, because maybe they were a little bit more faithful to what Dr. Seuss or Geisel was doing. I don't know.
I think that was part of it. Also, there might have been financial situations, because I know Chuck Jones had a little brief period around that time, early 70s, where, you know, he was producing stuff for shows like Curiosity Shop and stuff like that, but he wasn't doing as much as he was, you know. He did the theatrical Phantom Tollbooth, he did those Tom and Jerry MGM cartoons, so he was pretty busy in the 60s. And then as the 60s ended into the 70s, you know, but you know, there is kind of an overlap that you haven't, that is discussed in the book. So, as much as Ted and Chuck might have had friction, Chuck did work on the first DePatie Freleng one, which was Cat in the Hat. So, but that was the last one that Chuck worked on. So,
well, maybe he started it, and maybe it was pulled, maybe Frizz.
So, it has a little twinge of it, but it definitely looks like a DePatie Freleng production. But it, you know, it has a little Chuck, you can kind of see Chuck Jones' fingerprints on it a little bit, you know, when you watch that one compared to later Cat in the Hat specials that DePatie Freleng did by themselves.
So. They did, yeah. The Grinches, the Cat in the Hat or something.
Yeah,
like
things
that.
Like that.
Yeah.
Or even Dr. Seuss on the Loose, which has 3 stories, and Cat in the Hat makes a brief appearance in that. So
that's right. That's right. I think one more thing to add with Chuck Jones is he did the Pogo special,
which
I don't think it's been seen since it was made.
No. I don't think I've seen it, or if I did see it, I saw it when I was like three when it aired.
I remember <So. laughs> there was some film magazine, some film fan monthly thing, or a film collector's magazine back in the 70s where somebody had pogo cells. They had like stacks of pogo cells that they were selling for like $20 a piece. And yes, from the Chuck Jones thing. So
yeah.
But yeah, I haven't seen the special. And maybe a bit of it. It's not the greatest. And I think but anyway.
But as the 70s wore on, Chuck Jones did kind of make a comeback before working for Looney Tunes again, because he did a series of TV specials like Mowgli's Brothers, and I can't think of the Cricket at Times.
Cricket in Times Square.
Yeah, you know, things like that. So, you know, he did a few others that kind of, you know, put him back on the map as, hey, you know, I can direct things. Yeah, so I just kind of figured he had a little lull period, and Dr. Seuss figured I'll go with a more established studio for the rest of my cartoons, which he did until the Batty Freeling folded, and then he did a few more later with other animation companies. So
yeah, maybe Hanna-Barbera or something. I don't remember. I haven't kept track of that stuff. The one series that I remember from DePatie Freeling, The Oddball Couple.
Yes.
Once again, it's a cat and a dog.
Right.
Playing.
I actually like that series. I thought of their later series, you know, as you go into the 70s, you know, Oddball is a good descriptor for what DePatie Freeling would tend to do on Saturday mornings, because they went all over the map. Oddball Couple obviously is a riff on The Odd Couple, and but it's a TV version, so there's no Jack Klugman or Tony Randall or Walter Matthau or Jack Lemmon. You know, it's Frank Nelson is Spiffy, and Paul Winchell is what's the name of the dog? I can't remember the dog on the show. Right. I should know these characters.
Right.
But, you know, it's actually not a bad show. And it did finally come out on DVD. But that was the wave of what was going on in the 70s. I mean, Hanna-Barbera did like every TV show under the sun. And so did Filmation. You know, it was like, oh, there's Gilligan's Island TV show. Let's make a Gilligan's Island cartoon. Right. Oh, there's an I Dream a Genie TV show. Let's make an I Dream a Genie
cartoon. Lost in Space, Partridge Family. It all became Brady Bunch.
So
they just threw him in outer
really
space.
They had their foot in it too, you know, and it's like literally. Right. But they did some weird ones that, you know, I didn't even know until I did the book. I go, that was a DePatie Freeling. They did a version of Planet of the Apes.
And
it's done with Doug Wildey, who helped do the Johnny Quest show. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a Johnny Quest show, you know, and it's very serious. And I could have sworn up and down, because I saw it when I was a kid, I could have sworn up and down it was done by Hanna-Barbera Filmation. It wasn't done by DePatie Freeling.
Right.
They do the funny animal stuff. They don't do this serious stuff.
Yeah.
And there it is, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I guess they felt they had a change to kind of keep the work coming in.
Yeah.
They also did some interstitial stuff, I think, for ABC, which was this weird kind of.
Yeah. Well, they did these TV specials. There's the all-encompassing ABC After School Special title, and most of those were live action, but Hanna-Barbera did a few of them for that series, and DePatie Freeling did a few, and one's called Little Red and the Magical Mystery Machine or something. It's a long title like that. Mm-hmm. And it introduced this kind of weird looking character with a top hat called Timer. And
that's what I was talking about.
You know, later on they said, since this guy's semi-educational, let's animate a few more spots just to kind of fill in the gaps between cartoons. It's kind of like Schoolhouse Rock does, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like you always have to get that education quotient. So you had things like In the News, which is a news report for kids, and then you had the Schoolhouse Rock, which would teach you about grammar or multiplication or about the history of America or something. And then Time for Timer would come in there and he'd teach you about nutrition, you know, and tell you how to make a wagon wheel and weird things like that. I mean, it's really bizarre stuff, but memorable. It used to play endlessly. So like Family Guy has parodied it and stuff like that.
Oh, sure.
You know,
well, it becomes,
you know, it was part of the culture then. That's you didn't right. even think about it. It was just there, you know.
It was there, and you didn't know why it was. I didn't know why he was there. It was like, I'm looking at this weird character when I was like 15 and just like, what the heck is this? You know, this oddball weirdo character, you know.
Yeah, but so they did a few of those. Yeah. I list them all in the book. I don't remember how many they did. You know, they just played over and over and over and over for years, you know. Yeah. So everybody had them memorized, you know. I'm sure there's somebody out there, if you know, took callers or something, say, I can recite the whole thing, because, you know, it's like a 30-second spot or maybe in a minute or something, you know, and it has a little tune, and it's like, and all this stuff's on YouTube, so if you want to seek it out, it's all
I know it's crazy. What I was surprised about was you know, when they put these Pink Panthers out, I was hoping that they put maybe a few episodes of the show with the interstitial material.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's on any of the Blu-rays.
No. I did push for that when I was working with Greg Ford. Mm-hmm. There was kind of some sort of contractual reason. I think it was kind of a little BS, to be honest, but you know, yeah. We couldn't get it on there. That was a short answer, but
it's too bad, but it is on YouTube though. And somebody found them.
Well, actually you can go into, if you have Amazon Prime, they actually have the first season or two of the Pink Panther show with the opening credits with the Pink Panther and the inspector driving in the Panther mobile and stuff like that. Oh, coming wow. out of Grauman's Chinese Theater. So
are the prints cleaned up? I mean, is it does it look brand new?
Yeah, they're pretty good. You know, it's like gotta remember those theatrical cartoons didn't have a laugh track. On TV, NBC insisted they had to have a laugh track. So right. all the TV cartoons had a laugh track. And that was always a bone of contention when these started coming out. MGM did a Pink Panther set
right.
About a dozen years ago or something that's complete, but it does have some cartoons with the laugh track on it. So
right.
Greg Ford made sure to get versions without a laugh track. And if he couldn't get one, he had to meticulously remove that laugh track
wow.
to have a clean copy. And he had to do that in a couple of cases.
That's you know, crazy.
Not him personally, but the people working with him.
Right.
And so
that's wild. That's wild. What broke down DePatie Freleng? Because they went for years. They did some really excellent cartoons, I thought. And yeah. And then all of a sudden, it was just like, you know, you could see they're running out of gas toward the end of the 70s.
Yeah.
And, yeah, go ahead.
I think there's the reason that's obvious, which is they started doing more and more Marvel productions. So they did, like, Fantastic Four in the following year. That was successful. Let's do Spider-Woman the following year. Let's do Spider-Man. And Friz was never a fan of all that stuff. He liked the more funny animal stuff. Right. So the writing was on the wall that way. But to me, doing my research, the critical piece was in 1977, unexpectedly at lunch, David DePatie, Friz Freleng, and Bob McKimson were at lunch together. Bob McKimson had a clean bill of health saying, from his doctor saying, your heart's in great condition. You'll live to be 90. And he dropped dead at the lunch table the next day of a heart attack.
He was like, he was in his early 60s.
He was in his 60s, yeah, like 66 or something like that.
Yeah.
Totally unexpected. The last series he worked on was a TV update of Mr. Magoo called What's New, Mr. Magoo?
That's right. I remember that. I remember that show fondly. That yeah. because I thought it was done pretty well, but it was done in the Hanna-Barbera. It was in the DePatie Freleng style.
Yeah.
And but the characters were pretty much on model, you know.
Yeah, and they still got Jim Backus to voice him, so it had a connection at least that way.
Sure.
So, you know, some people hate him. I actually didn't think they were that bad. They also did the last things McKimson did was Baggy Pants and the Nitwits, which Baggy Pants was a take on Charlie Chaplin, which is interesting to me because he was still alive at the time those aired, but probably was pretty elderly, so probably didn't care, but there was no lawsuits or anything.
No,
and then the other half was the Nitwits, which were the two characters that sit in the park bench and Gladys hits the Man with the Purse.
That's from Laugh-In, I guess, Artie Johnson, Ruth Buzzy.
And they did their own voices again. So, you know, it has a connection that way. And that was the last stuff McKimson worked on. Everything after that pretty much was all superhero stuff. And McKimson didn't tend to work on that stuff. I mean, if you look at over the years with the Patty Freeling, there was pretty much two teams. And there's one team that worked on all the kind of funny animal silly stuff, and the other team worked on the more serious stuff. So the more serious stuff didn't start off right away, but then, you know, things came in, like I said, like, you know, the Planet of the Apes and stuff like that. So that was turned over to that team.
Right.
And they had different teams even for the music. There's one guy who did all the music for the sillier cartoons and one guy who did more serious music for the serious cartoons.
So it was Doug Goodwin.
Yeah, he did the sillier ones.
He did the silly stuff. But what I really liked, talking about the Pink Panthers, the Ant and the Aardvarks, where he came up with this, I call it drunken. It's almost like a bunch of musicians got drunk and they're playing this music for the theme. And so it has a Dixieland kind of quality to it. Not saying that Dixieland players are drunk, because I mean, but there's a sound where it almost sounds like they're having a party of some sort and playing these instruments, and so it's actually kind of neat to hear that, you know. But like the Pink Panther had this, you know, this really ultra smooth, sexy theme, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, that was a combination of, you know, Doug Goodwin, like you said, and also, you know, Henry Mancini, who composed the original theme.
And then the Inspector cartoons just basically goes after, it's just secret agent, you know.
Yeah, that's also a Henry Mancini theme, but
And that's from Shot in the Dark, or is that from
Shot in the Dark originally? And
yeah,
then he got his own series, like we said. And there's also a Inspector Clouseau film, but Alan Arkin played Inspector Clouseau in 68.
And I don't think it wasn't Blake Edwards didn't direct it.
And Blake Edwards didn't direct it. Yeah, it was directed by, I forgot who directed it.
Bud Yorkin?
Bud Yorkin. The guy who he was on the Dick Van Dyke Show as the neighbor, and I can't think. Jerry Paris.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And strangely enough, the guys who wrote the Inspector Clouseau film ended up writing the later Pink Panther movies for Blake Edwards. So eventually over time, it all got intertwined.
I guess so. because I remember when the first one came out, I think it was Return of the Pink Panther in the 70s.
Yeah. And then there's Strikes Back
and
Revenge.
Yeah. I mean, it hit like wildfire, you know. It was a big box office grosser. And it was a funny film. And then it was just like they had one like every other year, it seemed like.
Yeah. And then strangely enough, those two, you know, the Return of the Pink Panther and Pink Panther Strikes Again, Patty Freeling didn't do the animation for the titles on those.
Richard Williams, ironically. It was Richard Williams in England.
But there was a reason for that, because they were made in England for the English market, the movies, even though, of course, we can enjoy them here.
Sure.
But they had some strict mandate, at least on those two films, that they had to use a British animation studio.
Wow.
Which they did. That's why Richard Williams. But by the time they got to Revenge, they said, this is silly. DeFatty Freeling did the animation originally.
Yeah.
And so Art Leonardi took it upon himself, and he did the titles for Revenge. Which the most memorable part of that one is, you know, the big R that drops on top of the Inspector, if you remember those titles.
I do remember those titles.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Well, Art is definitely, he was a major talent, major player with DePatie Freeling. And I think they called him the jack of all trades. Everybody had a jack of all trades. So Disney had Ken Anderson, who was a jack of all trades. He could animate, he could lay out, he could do everything. And I think Art Leonardi was just indispensable, because they could put him in animation, they could put him in layout, they could have him direct, he ended up doing a ton of different things, titles, you know? And so really.
Now, I interviewed about 15 different people at least for the book, but the two that were the most helpful that really made the book work were Art Leonardi, because he remembered, at least at the time, everything, and kept everything. So
right.
He could help me with that. The other person was Barbara Donatelli. She was head of the ink and paint department, and she had every story under the sun, some I couldn't publish, unfortunately, but many that I could, right, about what happened in that department and, you know, who came through and what happened and everything like that. She was there day to day doing all that stuff. So,
right. Wow. So, well, I know, you know, just the way Art Leonardi draws, he's like, he has that style, you know, you can, yeah, see he lives and breathes that style. So, yeah. Those cut paper titles he did for the Ant and the Aardvark cartoons are, I always liked them. I always, yeah, liked them. And, you know, I never thought about who put this thing together. And it, yeah, was his idea to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, pretty amazing guy. And I worked with him, and I didn't know. I didn't know. I'm stupid.
Oh, well,
you know,
but if you do get those Kino Lorber DVDs, I keep promoting them, or Blu-rays,
right,
they carried over a lot of the documentaries that were on the old MGM set. In fact, I think they carried over all of them, and they produced a bunch of new ones that do have new interviews with the surviving members. Some have already passed away. Joe Siracusa did the music for a lot of these cartoons and sound effects, and
yeah,
he passed away recently. He was in his late terrible 90s, so yeah.
Wow.
But
well, Art's up there too, isn't he?
Art's in his 90s now. Yeah.
Oh my god! Yeah, I gotta get him on here.
Yeah, and I haven't talked to him for a while. Last time he was still doing well. Now, to answer your question, I guess I was wrapping it up with what happened with the Patty Freeling. And so, yeah, like I said, Bob and Kinson died. They were veering more and more into superheroes because Marvel Comics at the time still headed by Stan Lee, but Stan Lee wasn't really running the comic books. He just had his name on the masthead, just Stan Lee Presents. But Lee was like becoming more like a Walt Disney. He wanted more and, you know, more to do with movies and less to do with these comics. And so,
right,
he moved out to Hollywood and, he worked with DePatie Freleng on the Fantastic Four show. That's the one with Herbie the Robot. a lot of people complained about that, but there was like some reason why they couldn't use Human Torch. There's two reasons mentioned. One is Human Torch was leased out to somebody else, so they didn't have the rights to it. Other people have said, and we don't know which one's correct, that kids would light themselves on fire if they saw the Human Torch.
That's probably more like it.
Yeah, so
yeah, because anything that can be imitated.
Why they had a Herbie the Robot. Also, Star Wars was popular by that point. So let's have a robot instead of a flaming kid. You know, anyway, so.
Yeah, because you don't want kids setting themselves on fire throughout America.
Right. You know? So, like I said, that went through. Spider-Woman went through. And then they were working on Spider-Man. Friz Freleng was the older of the two, and he was getting up in years, and he said, I don't really need to do this anymore. And so he and David DePatie parted ways. It was a pretty amicable split, and Friz Freleng went on to do Looney Tunes things again, directing things like those compilation films, like the Looney Bugs Bunny movie.
Right.
And he actually did one more Pink Panther series in the 80s, but it was Pink Panther and Sons for Hanna-Barbera.
Right.
He did just a few more Looney Tunes projects and then just retired.
Right.
Whereas DePatie, being significantly younger, they sold the studio to Marvel. It became Marvel Productions. Mm-hmm. And after a slow start, they had their Spider-Man show, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And then they had a couple ones that really seemed like the Patty Freeling show. I don't know if you remember them, called Meatballs and Spaghetti, and one called Pandemonium with some pandas and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They did okay. They lasted a year. But then Marvel Productions started going into the day-to-day market, and then they produce like the afternoon block of like G.I. Joe and things like that, and Muppet Babies and stuff like that.
Right.
Those hit the big time for them. And so that's what they're known for. Right. People like Art Leonardi and all those people, they just stayed on for the ride, and they continued to work on for the better part of the 80s into the 90s. And then that studio split off and everything. DePatie retired. And now, in the back of my DePatie Freeling book, and this is with the help of Jerry Beck, we had to ascertain who owns what, because not one person owns all the properties of DePatie Freeling. Right. As, at the time of writing, all the Pink Panther theatricals and all those associated ones, Tijuana Toads and everything, owned by MGM. Mm-hmm. Anything that was by Dr. Seuss went back to Dr. Seuss. Planet of the Apes was 20th Century Fox. Of course, that's now owned by Disney, but at the time it was still separate. Mm-hmm. And you can go through all the Marvel stuff went to Marvel, you know, and everything like that. So,
wow.
And so you can't really reconstruct a studio out of it, but that's kind of what happened. It just kind of carried on as Marvel Productions, and then kind of just petered off as David DePatie retired. And then he just died this last year, you know?
Yeah, he was, not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Not too long ago. It's sad. They did some great work. Mm-hmm. You know, DePatie Freeling, I think the heyday, pretty much between 1964 and 1974, that's kind of like what I think is their heyday. And then basically it just started falling apart. But, you know, they gave us some good cartoons. They kept the cartoons going. And, mm-hmm. What I found very interesting was in New York here, we would see the Saturday morning, the Pink Panther show. Mm-hmm. And then it became the Pink Panther and a half, hour and a half show. I mean, they kept
laugh and a half hour.
I mean, they kept changing it.
Yeah.
And I guess every year they felt like they needed to change the name and the length of the show. I think at one point it was, was it longest an hour and a half, or was it 2 hours?
Yeah, it was that one. Yeah, that was the longest one. Most of them were a half hour, and they had a version that promoted the aardvark, and the last version was called the all-new Pink Panther show,
right?
Which was not on NBC. Strangely enough, most of the DePatie Freeling shows ended up on NBC.
Right.
A few didn't, but most did. Then I guess NBC at that point thought Pink Panther had run its course, been on for like 10 years almost. So ABC got the all new Pink Panther show. And that version had the last ones. They were made for TV, but they ended up being theatrical too. And that had the Crazy Lake Craig cartoons too.
Right.
So,
And I don't think they picked it up. I think it was on for one season.
It was just one season.
And then they dropped because the cartoons were pretty poor.
Yeah. Kind of. Pink Panthers are okay, but, you know, when you compare them to the earlier ones, they're pretty weak.
Yeah. Well, you know, you get into a formula, and it's almost like those Casper cartoons, you know, where it's like you've seen one, you've kind of seen them all, and they manage to keep it fresh for those initial maybe 5 years. And then, but, you know, after a while, they kind of start repeating what you're doing. And I understand that. I mean, they tried, you know?
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was when these shows were on NBC, I just remember, I don't remember ever seeing The Inspector. I do, but I used to turn the channel off because I didn't think they were very funny at the time, or I'd just get up and, you know, get something to drink or whatever. Then I'd come back and then, you know, it would be another Pink Panther on. But I like the Ant and the Aardvarks, but I don't remember any of I remember the Tijuana Toads only through theatricals. I saw them in theatricals. Yeah. And some of the other stuff, I don't remember it being part of that hour.
It wasn't. I mean, the longest version of the show, the laugh and a half, hour and a half one, that was when they called them the Texas Toads. So those ended up there the first time.
Right.
And they did a new feature that wasn't theatrical at all, but it was made for TV, and they put it as part of the show called Mr. Jaw. It's a takeoff on Jaws.
I remember that.
It wasn't Jabberjaw. That was over at Hanna-Barbera. Mr. Jaw had a top hat, and he spoke. It was Artie Johnson again speaking with the German accent.
Right.
You know, like, you know.
Which actually I found it better than Jabberjaw was Joe Besser, wasn't it?
No, it was Frank Welker doing Curly.
Oh, three okay.
Stages. Yeah, so okay. It is a whoop, whoop, whoop. Yeah, but Mr. Jaw, yeah, it was, you know, like this, you know, like a very interesting, that type of sound, you know. And then right. He had a catfish named Catfish, who was voiced by Arnold Stang, who basically does typical voice that he does, you know, for most of his characters, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, there's moments on this Mr. Jaw one. They made a lot of them. That's, I think, the problem with that. If they had kept it under, like, about 10 or 15 cartoons, but they made, like, 40 of them or something.
Oh, my God.
In a very short period of time.
Yeah, because they only made 17 Ant and the Aardvarks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
And, the only ones that they went more than 17 for the theatrical market were the Pink Panthers.
Right.
Everything else was that magic number 17. So
I figured 17 is enough. Let's do something else. Yeah. Well, anyway, look, the book is Think Pink, correct?
Think Pink, the DePatty Freeling story.
Yes. And that's available on Amazon. Is it available anywhere else or just Amazon?
Available on barnesandnoble.com. You can order it through the store, or you can also order it directly through Bear Manor Media. Sometimes they have discounts if you order directly through them. So, you know, you might want to consider that.
And all your other books are available on Amazon, too. So the ones we mentioned, Total Television Cartoons, you have a companion to that, which... looks pretty interesting. The Alvin, the story of the Ross Bagdasarian senior, and Frozen and Ice, which I want to have you back for that because that should be interesting. Because I have a feeling it's not going to be talking too much about the animated films. It's going to be talking about the live action.
Only the ones that were made during that period is 66 to 85, you know.
Anyway, Mark Arnold, thank you for joining us and talking about the DePatty Freeling cartoons.
Great.
Okay. Have a great one. Thank you.
Thanks, you too.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Hey. Anyway, thank you, Mark Arnold, for coming on our show today and talking about the DePatty Freeling Studio. I hope to have Mark back real soon, talk about Total TV cartoons and Ross Bagdasarian and Alvin and the Chipmunks and a whole bunch of other stuff. If you'd like to buy Mark's book, Think Pink, the story of DePatty Freeling, you can do that by going to Amazon.com. He has a whole bunch of other books on there about different subjects like Total TV cartoons and Alvin and the Chipmunks. So please check that out. Next week, we're going to do a show that's near and dear to my heart, because before I got into being an animator, I was a fan, just like every kid out there. And so I really, I discovered animation art pretty early and was buying animation art before it was really fashionable. It's kind of a thing now. So we're going to be talking about the history of that. We're going to be talking about the history of collecting animation art and what studios were selling their art, making it available to the public, and how it had some major renaissance back in the 70s, collecting animation art, and where it is today. Our guest is going to be Miss Debbie Weiss. She is the owner and operator of the Wonderful World of Animation Art Gallery in sunny California. And she'll be on. We'll have a nice discussion with her. If you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe or tell a friend. And telling a friend, that's the highest form of compliment for us. Basically says you like it, and I think your friend would like it. And so when you say that, that's really a one, two thumbs up thing. And if I had two more thumbs, I'd give it four thumbs up, according to a friend. Anyway, that's very important to us. We're available on a bunch of different services. We're available on Amazon. We're available on Google. We're on Apple, Spotify. Trying to think of all the other ones. There's so many others. We're just not available on Pandora yet or Sirius XM. We're working on that. We'll let you know when that's available. If you go on Alexa and try to listen to us, you may have a little bit of a problem because Cartoonerific is kind of a made-up name. And it's our made-up name. and it's how we identify ourselves. But unfortunately, when Amazon or Alexa, I should say, if you go on Alexa and you're trying to listen to our podcast that way, and you say, let me listen to the Cartoonerific podcast, it may misread it as terrific cartoon or something, and it may not come up. So the best way, and this was actually according to a friend out here in Long Island, he said to me, you know, it won't come up Cartoonerific, but if you say classic animated cartoon podcast with Brian Mitchell, most likely it will come up because it did for him. So try that. Anyway, I just want to thank everybody for listening. We have great shows coming up, and so I'm very excited about that. Willie Ito is coming up in a couple of weeks, and that will be a two-part episode. And he is a great artist, and he was a great interview, so I know you're going to enjoy that. Anyway, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have an even better week, and we hope to see you next time. Thank you so much for tuning in.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.